makes someone turn from unbelief to faith? The story is told of an atheist who went to Scotland and decided to swim across Loch Ness. Halfway across the lake, though, the Loch Ness monster suddenly appeared. The man panicked and shouted, "Lord, help me!" At which the monster instantly disappeared. Then from somewhere in the Scottish skies, a deep voice was heard. "You don't believe in me, but now you're asking for my help?" The man looked up and replied, "Well, 10 seconds ago, I didn't believe in the Loch Ness monster either." On a similar note, you may be familiar with the expression, "There are no atheists in foxholes," suggesting that on the battlefield, when the chips are really down, almost everybody turns to prayer. But even if that's true, even if that says something about people's perceived need for God, on its own, those kind of facts don't prove that God is really there, or that the Christian faith is true, for that matter. Indeed, when we read of the disciples of Jesus continuing faith in their master, even after he'd been put to death on the first Good Friday, one objection often raised is that desperate people can sometimes clutch onto all sorts of strange ideas, but that doesn't make them right or true. Our gospel reading, though, spells out how, for at least one of the disciples, faith in the risen Jesus was neither instantly comforting nor easy. On the contrary, for Thomas, he only came to believe in the face of the very strongest of evidence. The scene was set by what had happened on the first Easter Sunday, or rather a key detail about what had not happened. For though the risen Christ had met with the women by the tomb and then with others of the disciples who gathered together later in the day, Thomas had not been there. We've no idea the reason for his absence. We might perhaps think it could have been a sign he was less keen than the others, beginning to pull away from the company of Jesus' followers, but it could just have been impossible for him to get there for one reason or the other. Needless to say, though, it wasn't long before he was told what he'd missed out on. Verse 25, "We have seen the Lord," the other disciples said. But Thomas was adamant in his reply. Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and place my finger into the mark of the nails and place my hand in his side, I will never believe. You may have picked up the acronym FOMO, F-O-M-O, fear of missing out, and its slightly less common counterpart, FOMO with an H in the middle, fear of having missed out. Well, it seems Thomas wouldn't admit to being troubled by that kind of thing. On the contrary, it seems that he was convinced that the resurrection simply hadn't happened. We presume he took his fellow disciples to be either deluded or deliberately trying to deceive him, and he refuses to accept what they have to say. "Unless the same thing happens to me," he says, "and more than that, unless the appearing of the risen Jesus is such that I can touch the wounds made by the nails and the spear in his side, I will never believe." He doesn't entirely rule out the possibility of belief, but the way his words are phrased, he's not expecting to be given that kind of evidence. Nonetheless, the following Sunday, he's with the rest of the disciples as they gather for worship, again locking the doors to give themselves some protection from the authorities. And again, Jesus came and stood among them, declaring, "Peace be with you." And then all the attention turns to Thomas and what he will make of Jesus' appearance. As Jesus directly addresses him with the invitation, verse 27, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe. We're not told whether Thomas needed to take Jesus up on the invitation to touch his wounds. I think the implication is he probably didn't. Whichever way we read that one, though, it's clear Thomas is now very firmly in the believing camp. Verse 28, Thomas answered Jesus, "My Lord and my God." And in those words, Thomas clearly accepts, well, first of all, that Jesus is alive again, that he's risen. If you start off firmly convinced that God doesn't exist, then even a resurrection from the dead may well not make any difference or convince you otherwise. You'll say those who claim to be witnesses made it up or they were mistaken. Most people throughout history, though, most people, even in our secular 21st century, don't start with quite such a firm atheism. They either believe in God or they think there might be a God. And in either case, that means that a person rising from the dead could be a possibility if that God wanted it to happen. We won't be quite so closed to witness accounts if there are enough of them, if it seems to fit the evidence best to conclude they're true, we'll be willing to do so. Thomas, to this point, hadn't been convinced, but now with the added advantage of seeing the evidence face to face, he's sure that Jesus has risen. And if that leaves us saying, we'll hold fire on any faith until Jesus appears in the same way to you and to me, Jesus' own reported words encourage us that such caution is unwise. Verse 29, Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." And the gospel writer then confirms that we can't demand the eyewitness experience that Thomas had, but that even without that, in his view, the evidence that is presented in his gospel writing ought to be enough. Verse 30, now Jesus did many other things in the presence of the disciples which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. And we see in Thomas more than just a belief in the resurrection, but the drawing of conclusions about what that said about who Jesus is. Beginning with the acknowledgement, "My Lord." Thomas has clearly returned to the status of being a firm follower of Christ, who sees Jesus not just as one of many possible sources of guidance, but as his Lord and Master. Don't know if you've ever noticed, but in the English language, when addressing the aristocracy or royalty or the judiciary, it's always "Your Majesty" or "Your Honour," but "My Lord." And there's a very good reason for that. For while "Your Majesty" and "Your Honour" speak only of the status of the person being revered, "My Lord" describes the speaker's submission to their authority. Now, in the case of dukes or judges or lord bishops for that matter, it's a submission in a very limited area. When a person uses those words of Jesus, considerably more is entailed. And it's clear that for Thomas to say, "My Lord," is a big thing to say. And then the second part of Thomas's words, "My Lord and my God." As clear a statement as we find in the Bible, that Jesus isn't just to be thought of as God's representative or God's son, but more than that, that he is God come to earth. I've been reading the last week or so a book by a leading philosopher entitled, "Was Jesus God?" The author, Richard Swinburne, did a stint as an academic at Keele a few years back, so there may be some who came across him at that point. Most of his working life was a little later, though, as an Oxford professor. And he points out how some people inevitably say, know Jesus wasn't God, even after reading the Gospels, because they were firmly convinced before they started that God didn't exist in the first place. And no amount of written evidence, however remarkable, is going to be able to overcome their prior unbelief. Swinburne then adds how other people, though believing that there's a God, come to the evidence about Jesus with another strong prior conviction that God becoming man is either impossible or wildly unlikely. And again, he adds, if you start reading the Gospels with that presupposition, you may well find you're not convinced. But he then unpicks whether or not we really need to start with that kind of prior skepticism, with that kind of prior bias against thinking of Jesus as God. He said, if there's a God who loves us, well, shouldn't we at least be open to the possibility that that God might come and reveal himself to us? If that God made the human race to live in a certain way, wouldn't you expect him to try and communicate as clearly as he could what that way was like? And if, as it appears, the human race has taken a wrong turning, shouldn't you at least be half hoping that God might step into our world to rescue us? In other words, there's every reason to at least be open to the possibility that God might choose to come to earth as one of us. And if we then look at the Gospels with that initial openness, that maybe, just maybe, this could be the record of when that happened, Swinburne suggests that we will find the evidence for Jesus' deity to be very, very strong. Thomas's testimony is of special value because he's demonstrated that he isn't easily led, that he needed to be convinced before he would believe. And remember too, Thomas wasn't born from a background that expected God too readily to come to earth in person, though we can see in retrospect promises in the Old Testament foretelling, for example, God with us. In first century Judaism, their reading of the scriptures didn't lead to that ready anticipation. But nonetheless, Thomas saw enough to convince him that Jesus was risen, that Jesus was Lord, that Jesus was God. One person expressed the Christian conviction of who Jesus was like this: like man he walked, like God he talked. His words were oracles, his deeds were miracles. Of God, the true expression, of man, the finest specimen. Fully orbed humanity, crowned with deity, no trace of infirmity, no taint of iniquity. Behold the man, behold thy God. Veiled in flesh, the Godhead see, hail incarnate deity. And so we are encouraged to believe for ourselves, to share in Thomas's faith and his convictions about Jesus. That's not easy in our world. Christians are clearly in a minority, and we're sometimes presented as being credulous, of naively accepting what we were brought up with. If you think about it, though, in our culture, it's surely the agnostic or the unbeliever that is most in danger of having simply allowed themselves to be swept along by majority opinion. Being in a minority, as we now are, ought to have the advantage in making us consider very carefully our beliefs. And I'd suggest the evidence of the Gospels is just as compelling as it's always been, in demonstrating that Jesus is risen, that he's our Lord, and more than that, that he is God. Amen. We turn in our songbooks to number 33. O church, arise and put your armour on, hear the call of Christ our captain.
Thank you.